Tonight, we have artist Ryan McGinnis here to present The Logic of This Work is Stronger Than the Logic of the World in Which It Exists. This lecture is based on a 7-by-20-foot painting by the same title. And the painting is of his studio, and he's using it as a point of departure for addressing his different bodies of work and various aspects of his studio practice. So I think we're off to a good start because clearly he's put some thought into this, and I think it's a particularly creative way to structure a lecture. Ryan lives and works in New York. He grew up in the surf and skate culture of Virginia Beach, Virginia, and then studied at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as an Andrew Carnegie Scholar. During college, he interned at the Andy Warhol Museum as a curatorial assistant. Known for his extensive vocabulary of original graphic drawings that use the visual language of public signage, corporate logos, and contemporary symbology in his paintings, sculptures, installations, and books, the New York Times noted, quote, "In the past decade, McGinnis has become an art star thanks to his Warholian mix of pop iconography and silk screening." And then Vogue declared, "Ryan McGinnis is a leading pioneer of the new semiotics." Publications of Ryan's work are numerous, dating back more than 16 years. Most recently, the artist's book, Signals, Units of Meaning, Drawings of Elements and Compounds, was published this year and accompanied an installation last spring at Agnes B. Gallery Boutique, which is in Soho, where Ryan also launched his design for the Agnes B. Artist T-shirt collection. So you can kind of see the range of Ryan's practice, if you're not already familiar. You're about to be very familiar. Ryan's work is in the permanent public collections of the Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego, Cincinnati Art Museum, Museum of Contemporary Art in Spain, and the Tegushi Art Collection in Japan. Tonight's lecture coincides with Ryan's installation at the Public Trust in Dallas. It is one of the gallery's soliloquy exhibitions, and there will be a closing reception tomorrow evening. And you can get the details for that on the Public Trust website. And I also want to note that Brian Gibb, who is Public Trust, is here tonight and has offered everybody a poster of Ryan's work, but there was some complication. So he wants it just right, so he's going to give you a voucher on the way out tonight. So lucky you for being here. Anybody can listen to or watch the video podcast, you're going to get the poster. For now, we are fortunate to have Ryan here to present, as I said, The Logic of This Work is Stronger Than the Logic of the World in Which It Exists. Please join me in welcoming Ryan McGinnis.
Hi, thanks for having me, and thanks for coming. I really appreciate you coming out, and I enjoy speaking about my work and having every opportunity to share what I do with you. A quick note about the music that you were hearing earlier. That was one of the many playlists that we listen to in the studio while we're working. Every day we listen to music, and we publish all of our playlists on Spotify, so we were listening to Spotify earlier. We have songs for painting, songs for sketching, songs for varnishing, and songs for packing art, cleaning, studio visits and photo shoots, and we have songs songs to impress art handlers when we have people come in. Then we make sure that we have that playlist playing. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of the other systems that we have set up in the studio later in the talk. So the logic of this work is stronger than the logic of the world in which it exists is really to say that this painting and my paintings in general make more sense to me than the world around me. And I make work primarily for two reasons: to better understand the world around me, but also to create my own world and to invite you into that world. This is a studio view. It's a view of my studio. It's a painting that's 7 feet tall, 20 feet long, made up of four panels, 7 by 5. And it's acrylic on linen. These are some details of the painting. So we have silk screens on the floor with paint buckets, and those are sawhorses, and there's a ladder, and a little figure that I use in a lot of my work to show scale. And then we have another figure to show the scale of the scale person. And there's a side view of a squeegee resting on a paint container, and more screens. And then there, on the right, is a detail of a painting, of a painting of a painting. And those are more studio views. And what I'm going to do is use this painting as a point of departure and jumping off point to talk about 15 different aspects and bodies of work that are, you know, part of my studio practice. And starting with the metadata series, and you see I'm referencing this color chart from a photographer who's holding the color chart in front of the painting. Then we'll go through the Mindscape series, talk a little bit about sketch process. There's a whole body of work based on black holes, and then, of course, studio views and skateboards. Talk about scale shift, the systems, and this, you know, the studio systems of which the playlists are a part. The whole body of work based on figures and signage, painting process, non-Western art, art history, T-shirts, and then a fairly new body of work based on mother and child. So the metadata series is something I've been working on for about 8 years. And it really has to do with metadata, obviously, information about the information, assuming that the paintings are in and of themselves information. But they have to do, they're kind of like self-referential, and the work is really starting to fold in on itself. And here on the left you see it's a photograph of a painting with, again, the photographer's color chart in front. So when I have my work photographed in the studio, I'll have a photographer I've worked with for about 15 years comes in, set up lights, and takes really nice pictures of the paintings and uses these color charts. Most photographers do. And they're just a tool used to calibrate color in post-production and making sure that the colors are correct. So that's what a color chart is. And so, as I said, the process is really starting to kind of become part of the work and fold in on itself. And that's the case with the piece on the right, which are these squeegee trophies. These are the squeegees that I use in the silkscreen process that have been kind of fetishized and turned into a trophy. And these are more pieces where they're, on the left is actually a digital print onto canvas, and that digital print is sitting on top of painted buckets on top of the painted studio floor. And on the right is a reproduction of one of those squeegee trophies, again, mixed with paint on canvas, where it's sitting on these paint buckets on top of the floor, and with D-rings, and then these registration marks and crop marks, which reference, again, kind of print production, which is a part of my background. I went to school primarily for graphic design, and I also study painting. And so design is a big part of my background, my process. I have, by the way, a lot of images I want to share with you, and I'm going to go through them as quickly as I can. But know that if there's something that you want to go back to, we can easily go back. And so I'll spare you the actual detailed caption information for each piece. A couple more paintings from the metadata series. Obviously, there's a symbol for a shirt that becomes the content for the shirt, and then it's reproduced on the painting. And then on the right is a detail of a hand pulling a squeegee through a screen, and that becomes the content for the painting itself. So this idea of the work, again, kind of folding in on itself, is something that I've been exploring for a while because I've always been interested in symbols. And so with these metadata works, the the work is becoming the symbol, and the work, the process of making the work is actually becoming the content of the work. And in this mirror maze that I made with the drawings in vinyl that are stuck to the mirror, the drawings kind of replicate infinitely. And that also has to do with, or alludes to the fact that they actually can replicate infinitely because they exist as digital information. They're all vector files, and I'll show you some of that process a little bit later. These are a couple more metadata series pieces. These are very coarse halftones of photos of the sculptures being photographed and different sculptures at different times and layered on top of each other. So they also create kind of this moiré pattern. These are wigs that I made of my own hair over the course of about 8 years. And these are part of the metadata series, and of course they reference Warhol's fright wig. But an important thing to note is that they're my own hair, and they're real, and they're not, you know, they're not costumed, they're not put on. It's genuinely my own hair. This is what I call a closed system painting. So this is the painting in the middle, and the screens that were used to make that painting that frame it on the outside. This is the same idea, but in this case, the painting is actually directly on the wall. This is an installation where there's a simulation of my studio floor painted directly on the wall, and then real screens that sit on top of that, painted paint buckets, and then a real painting that sits on top of the simulated paint buckets, and then some captions that are on the wall. On each side are these, what I call these screen combines, which is a reference to Rauschenberg's combines. And so these are my old silk screens that I've bolted together and that serve as the ground for new paintings that I paint on top of. So again, this is a painting masked off and painted on top of combined older silk screens. And then I used these screen combines earlier this year for an exhibition in Los Angeles at Cone Gallery to make a maze. So you had to navigate around these screen combines to find your way to other paintings. Mindscapes make up the largest body of my work, and they are, it's almost like a catch-all phrase for most of my work. They are comprised of individual elements, so I'll call them like units of meaning, and these individual units of meaning are developed through a sketch process, and I'll show you some of that sketch process later, but the idea is that I'll make a whole body of work based on maybe one concept or one theme, and then through the process of silk screening, collage those different elements together to make the painting. This is about 8 foot square. And this is, as you can see, every little element is a separate screen, and in some cases, just a fragment of a screen. And I'll talk a little bit more about the process, but basically, every little element is a separate silk screen. This is a gold leaf on paper. In a gold frame that matches the gold leaf. And this is an example of where the images are a little more legible than, of course, being overlapped and fragmented in a painting like this. The images really come from a whole range of sources, from pop songs to psychedelic visions to, you know, more abstract or poetic thoughts to more blunt and pedestrian, you know, thoughts. But they all are the result of this kind of sketch process, and they're all original images, and they're all the result of developing images or icons or symbols. And that's how I learned how to draw, basically. Again, like I said, I went through a very rigorous design program, and I learned how to make images like this. This is black on black, about 8 foot square. Again, another mindscape. This is another mindscape called the Cosmic Giggle, and that's a phrase from Terence McKenna, who's a psychedelic researcher who passed away a few years ago. These are obviously tondos, about 24-inch diameter. And this is a woven silk piece, about 5 feet tall, and this is also woven silk. These are additioned pieces, maybe like an addition of five each. And the mindscapes get larger. In some cases, this is a view of my studio and an exhibition a few years ago where you can see the scale of some of these larger mindscapes. The third area to extract from that title paintings has to do with the sketch process. And so, as I mentioned before, drawing is really the foundation for everything I do. Every element is the result of a sketch process. And that process is my attempt at finding the kind of underlying geometry that informs the final form. I'm looking for an efficiency of shape and form. And I'm trying to use just perfect circles. I don't use arcs of an ellipse. I always use arcs of perfect circles, for example. And I always make sure that the lines are parallel, the lines are perfectly tangent when they need to be. These are a couple spreads from a book of all the sketches that were published between like 2000 and 2012. It's called Sketchbook Selections. I love making books, incidentally. It helps. I've always made books my whole life. Growing up, even in grade school, it kind of helps me organize everything. So I'm always making books. This is more examples of the sketch process. So in a way, I'm not making. I can't sit down and just make a beautiful drawing. Every sketch for me is a failing. And every iteration is one step closer to finding that final solution. So I'm not, in a way, I'm not making a drawing of a thing. I'm making a drawing of a drawing and trying to perfect that drawing. During the process of making of getting toward that final drawing, when I have I use the word solution. When I have that figured out, I will take the scan of, or make a scan of the drawing, bring it into the computer, and use it as a template to make a more technical drawing. And that's what you see in the lower left-hand corner here. And this is, again, what I was talking about before, by making sure that like all the lines are parallel and circles are perfectly tangent. And then that brings me to having what I call the final solution, which is the kind of a vector drawing. And a vector drawing, by the way, it's a mathematical equation. It's different than another kind of digital image, which you might be familiar with, like a bitmap image, like is what you get from when you take a picture with your phone or a digital camera. This is very different in that, like I said, it's an equation, so that it means it can be scaled infinitely up and down and can be replicated infinitely. And that's important for me because I have a deeper and deeper, deeper well of images, and I use the same images across different bodies of work often. But sketching also not only is important in creating the individual forms and those individual drawings, but also I use sketches and make little thumbnails to create studies for paintings and like little composition studies. This was the sketch that was used in the title painting. Because recently I've been asking myself if the sketch or the plan for the painting is enough to just be the painting itself. And so in that larger studio view, it actually is presented as the final painting. And so you can see that this relates back to the metadata series. These are two paintings in my studio that are propped up on the side. Again, just a quick thumbnail sketch for a larger, this is an 8-foot square painting. Now, the Black Hole series is a series of paintings where these flourishes and these kind of fleur-de-lis fold in on themselves. And my hope was that, there was this kind of aesthetic gravitational pull toward the center. The Black Hole paintings developed out of my interest in symbols for things that represented fanciness or wealth. And so I was looking at a lot of heraldry. And there are a lot of vines and plants and heraldry. And those vines and those forms have kind of turned into flourishes and, again, kind of like fleur-de-lis over the years. And so my goal with the Black Hole paintings was to make the absolute fanciest paintings I possibly could. and this was the result. And I've shown this was at the Cincinnati Art Museum. I've shown them primarily under black lights because, furthermore, I wanted to force a real world experience with the work. Although, obviously, this is a reproduction, it doesn't really faithfully reproduce what's going on here because the pigment that I'm using, fluorescence, there's fluorescent vinyl on the wall and then fluorescent paint. Those are real world experiences when you see those paints in person. So that's why it's important for me to not only work with fluorescent paints and some metallic paints, and I use a lot of iridescent paints and metallics, pearlescence, and it means that the work has to be experienced in person. This was an installation at Phillips, and everyone in my studio, we painted these fluorescent jumpsuits, and we wore it to the opening. And recently, the black holes have started to collect, and there's more than one black hole now in these picture planes. And this is a large print that I call Dark Energy, made up of many black holes. Studio views. Obviously, the title painting is a studio view, and within that painting are more studio views, and these are more examples. So at this point, the paintings themselves have become the symbols that I'm interested in. I experienced a bit of frustration, maybe starting around 10, 12 years ago, when the work became known as, it happens a lot, the work is known as like the artist's name, and so people wanted a Ryan McGinnis painting without really knowing what that means, and so I became a little distraught about that and felt like, well then this, you just want a symbolic painting or a representational painting of whatever that means, and so that's how these kind of studio views started. These are, but furthermore, these aren't paintings of painting, they're not reproductions of paintings that exist. They're, at the same time, they're primary productions, but they also imply that they are somehow reproductions because the first picture plane that you're looking at is a space in which something else exists. And so my hope was that I could collapse that disconnect between the symbol and the referent by making new paintings within a painting or studio view setting. And these are some of the studio views within the studio view, or within the studio. And so the idea of propping your painting up on buckets is kind of more, it's a bit of a convention in artist studios, and it keeps the paintings up off the floor and keeps them clean. It's not what I actually do in the studio. I actually prop my paintings just on 2x4s that are all cut the same length. But the buckets present more of a recognizable symbol, and so it's more of a symbolic gesture, and everyone kind of gets what that is. This is another, obviously it's a studio view. And then another studio view, a diptych, 7 feet by 10 feet. So this is this is an example of a painting that shows the two different directions that the paintings sometimes go in. One kind of more layered and illegible, and then sometimes the images are actually more legible and readable. And this is an extreme detail of this painting. Just so you can see some of the ideas I was talking about before with kind of fragmenting the painting and not doing it properly, not screening properly. Skateboards. So in that title painting, you saw some skateboards that were hanging on the wall of the studio. I love making skateboards. I grew up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and there's a big skateboard and surf culture, and I grew up skateboarding and building ramps, but I was never really any good at skateboarding. But what I was good at was painting all my friends' skateboard decks and drawing on the grip tape with metallic paint. And that's when I first really became interested in art, and I realized, and I would still go to museums and galleries from a young age, but I recognized that going into like a skate shop and looking at skateboards on the wall is exactly the same aesthetic experience as going into a museum and seeing oil on wood panels. They're all oil on wood panels, and you're ascribing value based on aesthetics and what's going on within those predefined picture planes. So I make different kinds of skateboards. Sometimes they're just painted, unique paintings. Sometimes they're more mass market. These are made with Alien Workshop Skateboard Company. These were published by Supreme in New York. And obviously they're color charts. And these were more limited edition skateboards. Oh, and then this past summer, this is a series of painted unique skateboards that I made. And this is actually an editioned piece, edition of five, published by Pace Prints. It's 12 skateboards that are laser etched and painted and bolted together, and the whole thing cantilevers off the wall. So not, you know, skateboarding and skateboards, a big part of my practice. Scale shifts. So you remember in that title painting there, all the scale is all out of whack. And so these absurd and surreal scale shifts allude to a kind of worlds within worlds model and kind of the fractal based model of the universe. So these are more examples of those out of whack and absurd scale shifts, because again, this is another world. These studio storage boxes were depicted in that painting, and this is a view of the studio, and you can see the sawhorses that are used a lot in the paintings too. I run a really tight ship in the studio, and everything has its place, and everything's kind of based on order and cleanliness. And that's out of a need to kind of facilitate the flow of, you know, the information out of me, and just to help us work more quickly and more efficiently. So if I'm reaching for, you know, a hammer or a screwdriver, it better be there. It better be in its place. We have these security identification studio passes, and these are. All of our paints, obviously. Every paint that gets mixed gets ascribed a unique number, and then we keep track of how we made that paint in a separate binder. All my sketchbooks are exactly the same size since 93, and so I would buy these traditional Mead school notebooks. And I got sick of trying to find them each time I needed a new sketchbook. And I would never stock up on them, so I just made my own. And I made that new kind of information in the front and back of those notebooks, you know, where they usually have like a multiplication chart and conversion charts or whatever. So in my sketchbooks, we have like some of the studio tools and different time zones, and those are my fingerprints. And then there are some jokes in there and palindromes. Anyway, the point is that all the sketchbooks are the same size, and they're all on the same grid paper. All my sketching paper is all 30 by 22 inches wide, and that's what you see in the upper right-hand corner. I have that custom made, so I never run out, and it's always the same size. The calendar to-do list pads we were making in the studio for years before I could find a publisher who actually wanted to mass produce them, and they are... I would just make them on a laser printer. They're half of an 8.5 by 11 sheet, and then we would, you know, clamp down all the pages and put the little pad glue on. But now, like I said, we have them mass produced every year, just in like an edition of like 1,000. But the point is that everyone in the studio has one of these, and that's the system. And you save your to-do list, and you put it back in a box, and then you have an archive of what you've done for the whole year, and then you move on to the next year. So we actually just got back from the printer 2017, so we're ready to go for next year. I made a studio manual that was published on the occasion of an exhibition I did in a museum in Madrid, where we reproduced the studio in the museum. And in this manual, I outline a lot of the different procedures and some of the standards. And so here we have the art production standards for the sketch process and for the drawing process. Sketch is what I used to refer to ink on paper, and then the drawing is the more technical drawings. Here we talk about the painting process in the manual and the standards for the signature and how to clean up in the studio. It's the studio manual is a parody of identity standards manuals that a lot of corporations publish to make sure that their brands and logos adhere to certain specifications. But it also has really real information. So it has real information, but of course the whole thing is a little tongue-in-cheek. Figures. So I have a body of work based on figure drawing, and that the process of drawing the figures is the same as the same process I use for drawing all the other bodies of work. So I'll draw from life primarily, and then later I'll make, again, kind of a drawing of a drawing until I've kind of perfected the forms. And so in the end, they're somewhere between figurative and abstract. And then once I have those elements, those final drawings, I put those together in paintings and sculptures, and these are a few examples of those. And this is a case where I've actually exhibited the screens that were used to make the paintings. These are porcelain-baked enamel on steel pieces. This is a material and a process used mostly for signage and street signs. I became really interested in it by looking at some of the older subway signs in New York. And these are neon figures and sculptures. These are welded aluminum painted in fluorescence and exhibited under blacklight. And speaking of signs and sign materials, I make a lot of, for lack of a better word, signage. And so I go back and forth between using these kind of images, which have, you know, they're kind of like of the visual language of like universal sign systems. And like I said, that's kind of how I learned how to draw. And those are kind of images that I'm attracted to. And so I will either subvert painting by including this kind of imagery in the painting and make paintings out of these, or subvert signage by making a lot of times image, you know, signs that can't be read when you would assume, because you're looking at what you normally understand as a sign, something that has more, again, kind of pedestrian information. But upon closer inspection, maybe you have to do a double take. They're a little more difficult to decode. So on the left is what I call a sign tree. That's about 10 feet high. And on the right are examples of signs that were installed by the Department of Transportation in New York. And this was a public art piece in Brooklyn by the Public Art Fund. These lamp posts already existed, so I made signs that matched the color. And again, the idea is that you would not notice them immediately, but maybe you'd have to do a double take and you'd go back to investigate more closely. And these are more sign trees. And so the signs and the sign aesthetic has found its way back into the painting. These are this is a 7-foot by 5-foot painting, this other series that I call The Signals. The painting process, as I've mentioned before, is really based on silk screening. And I first learned how to silk screen when I was in junior high. And this is actually a piece I made in high school where I'm purposefully misregistering. And obviously, it's based more on found line art. This is clip art from the 1950s, which I became really fascinated with in high school. And anyway, the point is, I've never silkscreened properly. I've never really done it the right way, meaning I don't use hinges, I don't use registration marks. It's a printing technique, obviously, that was developed for reproducing things in the same way each time. But the way I do it is very purposefully wrong. So, like I said, I don't use hinges, I don't use registration marks, and in some cases, I'm fragmenting images, and I'm misregistering them, and sometimes I'll just do one pull, and then we have to wash the screen. And in that title painting, you may have noticed a small sculpture, or painting of a sculpture, I should say, that was based on this body of work that I made based on the collection of that Pace Primitive in New York has. And so I looked at their collection of, it was mostly African art, and made a series of drawings based on objects in that collection. And then again, same as with all other bodies of work, collaged those images together to make a series of paintings and prints and some cyanotypes. So this is that same kind of sketch process, but collapsed onto one piece of paper. This is about 6 feet square. Art history makes up a large body of my work. I was, for years, making drawings of just some of my favorite pieces. This is a Raoul Hausmann sculpture, one of my favorite Dada artists. And then I did this in a more organized way for the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, where I looked at their permanent collection for about 2.5 or 3 years, and I made a series of drawings based on objects in their collection, not drawings that symbolized the individual works, but that were inspired by. So obviously this crown, or this face with the crown at the top, doesn't represent the painting as a whole, but it's just an element that I pulled out from the painting. So these are examples of some of that drawing process. Again, on the piece on the bottom, I just put the head and the hand in the lower right, which I've found the position of the hand really interesting. I just combined those together to make a drawing that was inspired by that piece. And then collaged all of those images together to make a series of paintings. These are some details. They have a triple Elvis in their collection. And this is one of the paintings kind of reverse engineered, so you can see where some of the individual elements in the painting came from. And those paintings are in the foyer of the museum. There are 16 total. And the whole piece is called Art History is Not Linear. And I did the same thing with the Boijmans Museum in the Netherlands. And this is one of the final paintings. And then we jump to t-shirts. T-shirts are also in that title painting hanging on the wall. Like with skateboards, I love making t-shirts. And so I will make shirts with a fashion label. This was a fashion label called M. Patmos. And I made these shirts with Uniqlo. And this is a shirt that I made with Agnes B. It's a Trump Loy shirt made to look like it's a shirt that I wear in the studio. It took 2 years to figure out how to make this for some reason because they're all spot colors. And so I like making shirts. There's not much to say about that other than it's just part of my practice. And I like making things on a broad range, you know, from site-specific installations and sculptures and paintings to t-shirts and calendars and books. Recently, I've been working on a mother and child series. And it's no coincidence that I'm a new dad. Now I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And I was drawing my wife when she was pregnant. And so I've been working on this series for about 5.5, 6 years. And so these are some of the final drawings, and this is what that drawing process looks like in one example. So I used those final drawings and combined them to make a series of monoprints with the Lower East Side print shop in New York. The end. Now, I hope you have some questions, because I would love to go back and explain things more or answer questions about anything.
This is kind of a large question, and it's not specific, but seeing the degree of order in your work and your studio, what role does chaos play?
What role does chaos play in the work, given that everything seems so orderly? And although I showed you some examples of rough thumbnail sketches for composition ideas, I usually don't have tight plans for painting. Or if I have plans, then I have also blocked out areas where I will go back in and rely on my intuition to build the painting. And that's the case with this painting. So there's a plan, an overall plan, as you could probably tell, that went into producing this painting. But the areas that are blocked out for, namely like the Mindscape paintings, could not be planned out. So I guess to answer your question, what role does chaos play? It's planned chaos. And so there are times when I'm working on a painting and I'm building it very intuitively and I'm going back and forth where it's always like a battle. You know, sometimes the painting wins, and I just have to sand it down and start over. And that doesn't happen if you enter the production of a painting with a plan. But the trade-off is you don't allow for all these kind of happy accidents. And so I feel very strongly, philosophically, that the process of making a thing should inform what the thing is, especially when it comes to making a painting. I'm at odds with making plans for painting, and I have people who help me execute those plans, because I don't think a painting or a good painting is an executed plan, because the artful decisions that go into making that painting have already been made. Like I said, I think the process of making painting should inform what the painting is. And so sometimes I allow for that in a very calculated way. And sometimes I don't.
So I follow what you're saying about interacting with some of the paint, like if it's metallic or fluorescent. But aside from that, is there a rationale to the colors you pick, particularly the Mindscapes, like super vivid, or is it just what you like?
There is not a rationale to the colors that I use. I make color decisions very intuitively and on the fly, like in a painting like this. I will try to balance color so that your eye bounces around the painting. If the idea with this is it's a full bleed paint, what I call, it's a printing term, like an image goes off the out and extends beyond the picture plane, or you assume that you're looking at a part of something larger, which is the case with this Mindscape. You're looking at a slice of this universe because some of the images are cropped off. And so I want an overall, I want you to kind of navigate through it evenly and go through it evenly. So I'll make sure that there's an equal amount of fluorescent yellow, for example, all the way around. Obviously, in a monochromatic painting, and there are a lot of color decisions to be made. But in something like this, where the background is fluorescent yellow, which is hard to tell again because this is a reproduction, decision made very intuitively. Yeah, yeah. The process of making the paintings looks a little something like having to. I paint everything flat, by the way, because of the nature of silk screening. And then we'll put the paintings up and look at them, put them back down, put them back up, put them down. But silk screening is done flat. So I'll work on maybe two or three paintings at a time. And I'll pull from a well of screens and then pull from a well of color at the same time and just feel out the composition and the color, again, just kind of intuitively. So it's not a satisfying answer because it's not a calculated approach to color.
Can you talk about the function, influence, or role of music in your painting?
I wish I could, other than we listen to music all the time. And I know nothing about music, aside from like being in a high school band, which everyone was in. But what was exciting about being in a band for me was making the cassette covers and making the flyers and making the posters. And I was fortunate enough to have a job on one of the Navy bases in Virginia Beach in high school. It was one of my high school jobs where I was doing that same thing. I was making flyers and signage and working with typography on Croy lettering machines and, you know, making three-color posters by swapping out the toner and the photocopier. And so after hours, I was able to work on propaganda for our band. But all that to say is, even though I love music, I know nothing about it. And you know, obviously, I shared with you some of our playlists. They're, I guess, built on tempo and tone, and you know, varnishing songs are quieter and stiller, and all the painting playlists tend to be a little more frantic because it's a really energetic process. But as far as the aesthetics go, I don't know. I just don't know.
Follow up with what Greg's saying. I mean, I'm really fascinated by your choice of these symbols, and if we had another lecture, I'd want you to like break down where these images come from. But it seems like the playlist would be a little bit like that. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it seems like there's a relationship, and I'm not sure there is a language for that, but it does seem like there's a relationship. The way you're sort of, as we said earlier, curating those two things.
Sure. And I guess the real difference is that with making playlists, it is curating things that already exist and that things that are made by other people, of course. And when I'm pulling together images for paintings, I'm curating things that I've made. And usually those things are made, again, kind of according to a body of work. All the mother and child images go together. All the figures tend to go together. The black holes tend to go together. The mindscapes, which are, again, are kind of like a catch-all, kind of all go together. But more to your point, each little drawing is a little, again, I use this phrase, kind of unit of meaning, and opens up a whole other world in and of themselves. So, for example, this, you would never know it, but there's this, I think it's from the 1800s, this cough syrup label that I saw of a man carrying a fish on his back. And that image or that concept always stuck with me. And I sketched it out one day, and then it just kind of evolved into this. And eventually the rope kind of disappeared, and you might not know or have any idea that it came from that originally. And this image actually comes from a little detail in a Bosch painting where a fish was swallowing another fish and it had a castle on its back. And I just thought it was so fantastic, and I had to own it for myself. So I created my own version of that. But you would never know that. It's so far removed from its original source of inspiration. Some of the more blunt images obviously are sawhorses and paint buckets and things in the studio and storage boxes. But let me see if I, you know, I saw this old etching of these monkeys like holding this fruit. And to me, it kind of spoke about, it has something to do with greed. And so I wanted to figure it out for myself and create my own version that was inspired by that. And sometimes I've just lost sight of, you know, the origin. I don't even remember where this one comes from, or what prompted me to draw that. You know, sometimes they're naughty. This is a French kiss on the left, and sometimes they're based on real existing logos. Like you see, there's the Bauhaus logo. It's a major part of the composition of the painting on the right. And then I took the Bauhaus logo and actually perfected it because all the elements don't line up in it for some reason. And then I mirrored it and turned it into what's simultaneously two people facing each other, but also a face. Anyway, so that's where that came from. There's a butterfly with large testicles, which to me is very kind of feminine, and, you know, very masculine image kind of merged together. So some of them are surreal, some of them are naughty, some of them are really blunt, some of them reference art history, some of them reference painting itself. There are obviously some drips on the top left of that painting. This skull image in the kind of right side is based on Misfits cover album, Misfits logo. The band Misfits. But you might not notice that because it's kind of removed from that. Anyway, so I could go on forever. But.
I have a question about that because I saw a couple of years at the McNay in San Antonio that did have naughty image or icons or whatever. Is there any sort of statement on it, or is it just naughty?
Oh, no. There's always some kind of personal concept behind some of the naughtier ones, for example, and behind all of them. So let's look at this one, for instance. This is actually called, what is this called? This is Reasoned Relationships versus Illogical Love. And I made this at a time when I was torn between two women. And one of the naughtier images is this skull and coming out and facing the person. The skull is an extension of the penis, and he's facing the person. And it's a little abstract, but I think you can make it out. And then there's a Grim Reaper next to that. There's also below this skull and penis is a snake that is fragmented, and the tongue, it's actually really small here, is a key to its own heart. And there's in the middle on the bottom is another kind of snake that's broken, and again its tongue is forked and also serves as the key to its own heart, and it is inside this tree made of breasts. And then I could kind of go on and on, but some of them are really personal and you would never really know. Some of them are open to interpretation in that way. The work also serves as kind of a Rorschach test of sorts. Anyway.
Hi, thank you very much for your lecture. I have two short questions. The first one is, it reminds me a little bit on like a factory of ideas. And in this factory you have a team of people who produce ideas. And so what is the relationship to the idea? And the second one is, to what extent, whatever you produce on ideas, where it comes that these ideas are executed? And what is worse to execute? How is this second shift, I would call, being made up in your work? Sorry for my betting.
No. So this idea of the work being simply an expression of an idea, maybe more conceptually based work.
Ideas,
sure.
Producing, just get it out.
Sure. So
second is sorry to interrupt. Is,
yeah, no.
How you organize it?
Yeah.
So how you say this is I take this is just a waste.
Yeah. Which is
like
hard for
very
me.
Efficient.
Yeah.
And it's kind of industrialized, like a factory who knows what comes out and what stays in the space.
So I used to make, in my 20s, after I graduated school and moved to New York right away, I used to make what I would call neat idea art, where it was a simple idea that was executed, and maybe only cerebral, and not super heavy, but just kind of a neat idea. And I still see and recognize neat idea work everywhere, and I really wanted to make something more heartfelt and genuine. And those neat ideas, incidentally, were very ironic and sarcastic and all the attributes that are usually expressed by 20-somethings. But I wanted to make something that was a little more... I wanted to make work that was more honest and genuine, obviously. We all do, I guess. And for me, I had a big breakthrough. It must have been like 99 or 2000 because I was supporting myself by doing design work and then also being in group shows and making paintings. And so I would have both of these kinds of things up in the studio. And so when my friends would come over and we would hang out and talk about work, they would always gravitate toward, you know, the design work and the iconic work and recognize that as something that was unique unto me. And that wowed my friends because they had no idea how that kind of thing was made or how you could even like draw that way. And so recognizing that they recognized that that was unique to me helped me break through and become more comfortable with that being my work. And that's just aesthetically. And so even though there wasn't much of a precedent and maybe still isn't for this kind of aesthetic in the kind of so-called art world or art worlds, it was with the encouragement of my friends that I started to make that kind of work and not care if anyone regarded it as art or not, really, because I was just making what I had to make. And also a lot of the neat ideal work was work that I could have outsourced and fabricated by other people. And for me, being involved in the process is very important because craft and the work being an extension of my own hands and bodies is important to me. I don't know exactly why, other than it's an expression of just one of my core values and what I think, you know, or what I value in art, I should say. That doesn't quite answer your question, I don't think. But the second question is how do I kind of organize all of these ideas, I guess?
And how you distinguish with that what you develop and to what, where is the point where you actually produce this for an exhibition or just do you work in a team? Do you have employees, assistants?
Yeah, I have a few assistants in the studio, and then we'll still work with some outside fabricators when we can't make the things in the studio ourselves. But so I guess 2 points. Organizing the ideas comes back to this idea of systems in the studio. And so my biggest fear is that I will leave an idea behind. And so the first dumping ground for all the ideas is a sketchbook. And so everything gets thrown in a sketchbook. And then I will go through the sketchbooks later and decide, well, what kind of bubbles up and comes to the surface after a number of weeks or even years. So I'm always going back through old sketchbooks. And then maybe deciding what... Sometimes I just have neat ideas that are better expressed in something lighter, like a T-shirt. Like, so I don't think a T-shirt is a very serious cultural contribution. And it might be a perfect match for what might not be a very serious idea, you know. So I'll find maybe matches that way. I did this whole series. For some reason, I got it in my head to make 1,000 buttons of just typographic phrases. And so I would always write them down in my sketchbook. And so if I had, you know, 20, 25 years of these ideas I never had anything to do with until Instagram came around. And so everyone told me, oh, you should really get on Instagram, you should get on Instagram. And I'm not an early adapter of anything. So I thought about it for 3 months, and then 6 months went by, and I decided the best match for Instagram is to produce something site-specific to the medium that only exists on Instagram. And so I started publishing all these little black and white buttons made up of these little typographic phrases. And then, well, this is the perfect outlet for those ideas because each one represents something very light. It's very kind of pithy saying or something that wasn't had no outlet. And then so now I had an outlet. So then I published over the course of 3 years 1,000 of these black and white little buttons, which actually I use on these calendars here. That's why I'm pointing to those. Those, and nobody knew this, little black buttons turned out to be halftone dots in a larger image, which was the self-portrait that was revealed after 3 years. So the Instagram project started to zoom out, and then you could see that all the dots made up one larger. It was like, it was at Sotheby's 20 feet high portrait, coarse halftone. And all those little dots, it turns out, made up a self-portrait. And the project was Instagram, capital I, capital A-M, I am Instagram. Mm-hmm. And so that was an example of a perfect match for an outlet or a production or a publishing opportunity for these ideas that I had been collecting for a number of years. And what I learned from that project is that nobody gives a shit. Like, nobody cares. Like, sometimes you get, like, wrapped up in your own little ideas and you just like and also there's no way to monetize that, so I lost so much time and energy and work, and but I still have, because again, these are all vector files, they're all digitally based images, I still have these 1,000 buttons, which I'll probably use for a button piece in the future at some point. Anyway, that's a long-winded one example of collecting idea and then finding an outlet for it. Yeah, sorry. Yes.
Does it make you crazy driving down the street and seeing all the bad logos?
Bad logos and bad typography. I studied typography very seriously in school, and I couldn't look at signage anymore because I only saw the typography and stuff. And I got over that, and now I actually liked. I think it's coming back to this idea about silk screening incorrectly. I think it's important in almost. Almost everything is to know better but do worse. That's actually a button. Know better, do worse. And what it means is, obviously, it's not that difficult to decode. It means what it means. It's, you know, you know how to do things correctly first, and then you decide to do things incorrectly, very purposefully. So a lot of the buttons were, even though I'm a big fan and student of typography, a lot of the buttons were very poorly typeset, and I chose the worst typefaces, and I did wrong. And again, that concept holds true for silk screening, because I think when you know, as an artist or creator of any sort, and you're making a contribution to culture, you can either raise the bar or you can lower the bar. The point is that you don't want the bar; you want to move the bar. In raising the bar, hopefully you inspire people to do better. You know, in lowering the bar, punk, for example, three chord rock, you also allow people to come in because you show how easy it can be. And so I tried to do both things, to really screen in a very kind of fucked up way to show that, hey, you know, anybody can do this. But then it's also within very kind of tight at work, and the individual things that I'm screening are so technically precise that hopefully in that regard I'm raising the bar.
I don't know, it may be just because of what I've been thinking about, but I noticed this right from the start that a big array, or I guess you called it your studio, it's kind of like your life work.
Oh, sure.
And I noticed it there, and then I kept noticing it again. In amongst all of the clutter of ideas, there appear a lot of cartouches. And, you know, Egypt has been on my mind for the last several days. And, you know, and especially something like skateboards. Because out of the out of the whole array of material, the skateboards kind of come out and, in my mind, order them and draw. And skateboards are also, in a way, a cartouche. Mm-hmm. When a decorated skateboard is kind of like a signature for the skateboarder. And you know, in Egyptian art, amidst all of the confusion of language, you're drawn to these little capsules. There's one. Mm-hmm. And these capsules that contain somebody's identity. Yeah. There are two more down in the lower square. Three skateboards over on the left, and mm-hmm. then that partially filled one in the center. Do you, and I thought, you know, maybe this idea of capturing little windows. And once I thought that, I thought, well, there are a lot of little windows in the work mm-hmm. where they kind of arrest you, and there's something contained here, some identity.
Yeah, that's true, especially obviously of the studio views where you're looking at a work of works. And so in making the studio views, I've been able to use the format and the concept as a way to bring together all these different bodies of work, which up to this point I've always compartmentalized. And there's been this, and the whole practice in my head has been very fragmented. So I've had the black holes and the figures and, you know, the mindscapes and, you know, all these other bodies of work. And so making these studio views has been a way for me to kind of reconcile all the different bodies and bring them together. And now there's a lot of crossover in the work, and it feels just a little more holistic instead of fragmented. So it's been therapeutic for me to make these paintings that have these individual kind of windows.
Yeah, it was interesting hearing you talk about the button project, at the end of which you ended up using those as sort of grayscale dots for a self-portrait, because the whole process of almost everything, I mean, especially things like the mindscapes, but like almost all of these are layers of images, but they're at different scales. They're not all the same thing as the buttons. And they're like different scales, different colors, different everything. And like, I can't imagine how many different screens you have of any one image, because you have so many of them at so many different scales. But the idea of having the buttons that are all basically at the same scale, at least when you originally did them, to turn that into like a more literal picture when all of these others are... in some ways maybe more imaginative, evocative, whatever kinds of less literal self-portraits is such another richer idea than like what you ended up doing with those buttons in some ways. It's a great idea to have done it.
Right.
But it's also a great idea that you didn't show it to us.
Because that just confuses the issue.
The other ones are so much... Yeah. What's going on in your head, is it? So they're different portraits.
Yeah. And of course, I'm trying to bring up the Instagram project so I can show you, and then also show you some other button pieces that I've done where I've literally made buttons. I'm doing this because that's a button machine that's used to make buttons. And those other button pieces are buttons pinned to a canvas that make up a larger kind of meta image. But I definitely hear you, and maybe it was better not to show you that, but it's certainly more honest to show you
well,
that.
And
now you know my pain.
Like the most literal piece of anything you show.
Yeah.
Well, other things.
While that's loading, let's take another question. Yeah.
As your work has become more meta, how has that affected how it's perceived? I mean,
oh, I don't know. I mean, you tell me.
I don't know, because it could be seen as sort of, you know, self-obsessed and whatever, or it could be seen as pushing something. So I'm just wondering how has any dialogue, and do you pay attention to that?
I don't pay attention to it, but I do recognize that it's a dead-end pursuit. You know, you can only go so far with making paintings of paintings and referencing your own work. But it's something that I needed to do because I felt like I was at a point where I was making so many different bodies of work. I had to kind of reconcile where they, how they fit together. Besides the fact that, you know, drawing, in the process of drawing and making those kind of iconic and symbolic images drive all the work. I couldn't put the pieces together. Now that I've put those puzzle pieces together, I'll move on to another body of work. You know, I don't know what that will look like. Yeah, sorry, it's still loading.
Well, the idea of the meta is clearly something that's of this moment. I mean, there's a real fascination with meta at this moment. And I guess maybe the internet is plays some role in that we're looking at information of information. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just. I was going to ask you about that too. If in doing this metadata, you had any realizations or any theory on our current fascination with this notion of information of information of information.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You're part of the zeitgeist.
Maybe, but I don't, you know, I feel so disconnected from this world. I just feel like I'm in my own world. And so maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe the timing is certainly the timing is right for me. It, again, kind of reconcile all these different bodies of work and also take time. I'm at the point in my career I like to call emerging mid-career, where I can kind of assess what I've done. And one of my goals has been for the past couple of years, maybe I'll get to it this year, is to make one large periodic chart of all the individual drawings that I've ever made in order to find the gaps and find where I should fill in the gaps. And I hope to do that. And that then I'll know where I've been, obviously, and then I'll know where to go. I need to.
You're killing me with this. It's so interesting. I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe we've caught up. We've caught up to you because of the internet. But maybe that's the way your brain always works. I don't know.
Yeah. Sorry, this isn't loading. But I want, if you get a chance.
I was going to say,
yeah, yeah. It's buried because now it's maybe a year and a half ago that I finished it. I started it four and a half years ago. Yeah.
We can.
Another question, please.
I think we may be out of time.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to keep it? You're waiting for the...
Okay. Yeah. All right, thanks.